Logic, Deductive and Inductive, by Carvath Reed. Chapter 4. The Connotation of Terms. Section 1. Terms are next to be classified according to their connotation, that is, according to what they imply as characteristic of the things denoted. We have seen that general names are used to denote many things in the same sense, because the things denoted resemble one another in certain ways. It is in this resemblance in certain points that lead us to class the things together and call them by the same name. And therefore, the points of resemblance constitute the sense or meaning of the same, or its connotation, and limit its applicability to such things as have these characteristic qualities. Sheep, for example, is used in the same sense to denote any of a multitude of animals that resemble one another. Their size, shape, woolly coats, cloven hoofs, innocent ways, and editability are well known. When we apply to anything the term sheep, we imply that it has these qualities. Sheep denote the animal, connotes its possessing these characteristics. And, of course, it cannot, without a figure of speech or a blunder, be used to denote anything that does not possess all these qualities. It is by a figure of speech that the term sheep is applied to some men, and to apply it to goats would be a blunder. Most people are very imperfectly aware of the connotation of the words they use, and are guided in using them merely by the custom of the language. A man who employs a word quite correctly may be sadly posed by a request to explain or define it. Moreover, so far as we are aware of the connotation of terms, the number and the kind of attributes we think of in any given case vary with the depth of our interest, and with the nature of our interest in the things denoted. Sheep has one meaning to a touring townsman, a much fuller one to a farmer, and yet a different one to a zoologist. But this does not prevent them from agreeing in the use of the word, as long as the qualities they severally include in its meaning are not incompatible. All general names, and therefore not only class names, like sheep, but all attributives, have some connotation. Woolly denotes anything that bears wool and connotes the fact of bearing wool. Innocent denotes anything that habitually and by its disposition does no harm or has not been guilty of a particular offense, and connotes a harmless character or freedom from particular guilt. Edible denotes whatever can be eaten with good results, and connotes its suitability for mastication, deglutition, digestion, and assimilation. Section 2. But whether all terms must connote, as well as denote something, has been much debated. Proper names, according to what seems the better opinion, are in their ordinary use not connotative. To say that they have no meaning may seem violent. If one is called John Doe, this name, no doubt, means a great deal to his friends and neighbors, reminding them of his stature and physiognomy, his air and gait, his wit and wisdom, some queer stories, and an indefinite number of other things. But all this significance is local or accidental. It only exists for those who know the individual or have heard him described, whereas a general name gives information about anything or person it denotes to everybody who understands the language, without any particular knowledge of the individual. We must distinguish, in fact, between the peculiar associations of the proper name and the commonly recognized meaning of the general name. This is why proper names are not in the dictionary. Such a name as London, to be sure, or Napoleon Bonaparte, has a significance not merely local. Still, it is accidental. These names are borne by other places and persons than those that have rendered them famous. There are Londons in various latitudes, and no doubt many Napoleon Bonapartes in Louisiana, and each name has its several denotations and altogether different suggestiveness. For its suggestiveness is in each application determined by the peculiarities of the place or person denoted. It is not given to the different places, or to the different persons, because they have certain characteristics in common. However, the scientific grounds of the doctrine that proper names are non-connotative are these. The peculiarities that distinguish an individual person or thing are admitted to be infinite, and anything less than a complete enumeration of these peculiarities may fail to distinguish and identify the individual. For short of a complete enumeration of them, the description may be satisfied by two or more individuals, and in that case the term denoting them, if limited by such a description, is not a proper but a general name, since it is applicable to two or more in the same sense. The existence of other individuals to whom it applies may be highly improbable, but if it be logically possible, that is enough. On the other hand, the enumeration of infinite peculiarities is certainly impossible. Therefore, proper names have no assignable connotation. The only escape from this reasoning lies in falling back upon time and place. the principles of individuation as constituting the connotation of proper names. Two things cannot be at the same time in the same place. Hence, the man who was at a certain spot on the bridge of Lodi at a certain instant in a certain year suffices to identify Napoleon Bonaparte for that instant. Supposing no one else to have borne the same name then, is this its connotation? No one has ever thought so, and, at any rate, time and place are only extrinsic determinations, suitable indeed to events like the Battle of Lodi, or to places themselves like London, whereas the connotation of a general term, such as sheep, consists of intrinsic qualities. Hence, then, the scholastic doctrine that individuals have no essence, and Hamilton's dictum that every concept is inadequate to the individual, are justified. General names, when used as proper names, lose their connotation, as Euxine or Newfoundland. Singular terms, other than proper, have connotation, either in themselves, like the singular pronouns he, she, it, which are general in their applicability, though singular in application, or, derivatively, from the general names that combine to form them, as in the first emperor of the French, or the capital of the British Empire. Section 3. Whether abstract terms have any connotation is another disputed question. We have seen that they denote a quality or qualities of something, and that is precisely what general terms connote. Honesty denotes a quality of some men. Honest connotes the same quality whilst denoting the men who have it. The denotation of abstract terms thus seems to exhaust their force or meaning. It has been proposed, however, to regard them as connoting the qualities they directly stand for and not denoting anything. But surely this is too violent. To denote something in the same as to be the name or something, whether real or unreal, which every term must be, it is a better proposal to regard their denotation and connotation as coinciding, though open to the objection that connote means to mark along with something else, and this plan leaves nothing else. Mill thought that abstract terms are connotative, when besides denoting a quality that suggests a quality of that quality, as fault implies hurtfulness, but against this it may be urged that one quality cannot bear another. Since every qualification of a quality constitutes a distinct quality in the total, milk whiteness is distinct from whiteness. After all, if it is the most consistent plan, why not say that abstract, like proper, terms have no connotation? But if abstract terms must be made to connote something, should it not be those things, indefinitely suggested, to which the qualities belong? Thus whiteness may be considered to connote either snow or vapor, or any white thing apart from one or other of which the quality has no existence, whose existence therefore it implies. By this course, the denotation and connotation of abstract and of general names would be exactly reversed, whilst the denotation of a general name is limited by the qualities connoted. The connotation of an abstract name includes all things in which its denotation is realized. But the whole difficulty may be avoided by making it a rule to translate, for logical purposes, all abstract into the corresponding general terms. Section 4. If we ask how the connotation of a term is to be known, the answer depends upon how it is used. If used scientifically, its connotation is determined by, and is the same as, its definition, and the definition is determined by examining the things to be denoted, as we shall see in Chapter 22. If the same word is used as a term in different sciences, as property, in law, and in logic, it will be differently defined by them and will have, in each use, a correspondingly different connotation. But terms used in popular discourse should, as far as possible, have their connotations determined by classical usage, i.e., by the sense in which they are used by writers and speakers who are acknowledged masters of the language, such as Dryden and Burke. In this case, the classical connotation determines the definition, so that to define terms thus used is nothing else than to analyze their accepted meanings. It must not, however, be supposed that in popular use, the connotation of any word is invariable. Logicians have attempted to classify terms into univocal, having only one meaning, and equivocal, or ambiguous, and no doubt some words, like civil, natural, proud, liberal, humorous, are more manifestly liable to ambiguous use than some others. But in truth, all general terms are popularly and classically used in somewhat different senses. Figurative, or tropical language, chiefly consists in the transfer of words to new senses, as by metaphor or metonymy. In the course of years, too, words change their meanings, and before the time of Dryden, our whole vocabulary was much more fluid and adaptable than it has since become. Such authors as Bacon, Milton, and Sir Thomas Browne often use words derived from the Latin in some sense they originally had in Latin, though in English they had acquired another meaning. Spenser and Shakespeare, besides this practice, sometimes use words in a way that can only be justified by their choosing to have it so. Whilst their contemporaries, Beaumont and Fletcher, write the perfect modern language, as Dryden observed. Lapse of time, however, is not the chief cause of variation in the sense of words. The matters which terms are used to denote are often so complicated, or so refined in the assemblage, interfusion, or gradation of their qualities, that terms do not exist in sufficient abundance and discriminativeness to denote the things and, at the same time, to convey by connotation a determinate sense of their agreements and differences. In discussing politics, religion, ethics, aesthetics, this imperfection of language is continually felt. And the only escape from it, short of coining new words, is to use such words as we have, now in one sense, now in another, somewhat different, and to trust to the context, or to the resources of the literary art, in order to convey the true meaning. Against this evil, the having been born since Dryden is no protection. It behoves us, then, to remember that terms are not classifiable, and univocal, and equivocal, but that all terms are susceptible of being used equivocally, and that honesty and lucidity require us to try, as well as we can, to use each term univocally in the same context. The context of any proposition always proceeds upon some assumption or understanding as to the scope of the discussion, which controls the interpretation of every statement and of every word. This was called by De Morgan the universe of discourse. An older name for it, revived by Dr. Venn, and surely a better one, is suppositio. If we are talking of children and play is mentioned, the suppositio limits the suggestiveness of the word in one way, whilst if Monaco is the subject of conversation, the same word play, under the influence of a different suppositio, excites altogether different ideas. Hence to ignore the suppositio is a great source of fallacies of equivocation. Man is generally defined as a kind of animal, but animal is often used as opposed to and excluding man. Liberal has one meaning under the suppositio of politics, another with regard to culture, and still another as to the disposal of one's private means. Clearly, therefore, the connotation of general terms is relative to the suppositio, or universe of discourse. Section 5. Relative and absolute terms. Some words go in couples or groups, like up-down, former-ladder, father-mother-children, hunter-prey, cause-effect, etc. These are called relative terms, and their nature, as explained by Mill, is that the connotation of the members of such a pair or group are derived from the same set of facts, the fundamentum relationis. There cannot be an up without a down, a father without a mother, and a child. Therefore, cannot be a hunter without something hunted, nor prey without a pursuer. What makes a man a hunter is his activities and pursuit, and what turns a chamois into prey is its interest in these activities. The meaning of both terms, therefore, is derived from the same set of facts. Neither term can be explained without explaining the other, because the relation between them is connoted by both, and neither can with propriety be used without reference to the other, or to some equivalent, as game for prey. In contrast with such relative terms, others have been called absolute or non-relative. Whilst hunter and prey are relative, man and chamois have been considered absolute, as we may use them without thinking of any special connection between their meanings. However, if we believe in the unity of nature and in the relativity of knowledge, that is, that all knowledge depends upon comparison or perception of the resemblances and differences of things, it follows that nothing can be completely understood except through its agreements or contrasts with everything else, and that all terms derive from their connotations from the same set of facts, namely from general experience. Thus, both man and chamois are animals. This fact is an important part of the meaning of both terms, and to that extent they are relative terms. 5 yards and 5 minutes are very different notations, yet they are profoundly related, for their very difference helps to make both notions distinct. And their intimate connection is shown in this, that 5 yards are traversed in a certain time, and that 5 minutes are measured by the motion of an index over some fraction of a yard upon the dial. The distinction, then, between relative and non-relative terms must rest, not upon a fundamental difference between them, since, in fact, all words are relative, but upon the way in which words are used. We have seen that some words, such as up-down, cause-effect, can only be used relatively, and these may, for distinction, be called correlatives. But other words, whose meanings are only partially interdependent, may often be used without attending to their relativity, and may then be considered as absolute. We cannot say the hunter returned empty-handed, without implying that the prey escaped, but we may say the man went supperless to bed, without implying that the chamois rejoiced upon the mountain. Such words as man and chamois may then, in their use, be as to one another non-relative. To illustrate further the relativity of terms, we may mention some of the chief classes of them. Numerical order. First, second, third, etc. First implies second, and second first, and third implies first and second. But these do not imply third, and so on. Order in time or place. Before, after. Early, punctual, late. Right, middle, left. North, south. As to extent, volume, and degree. Greater, equal, less. Large, medium, small. Whole and part. Genus and species are a particular case of whole and part. Sometimes a term connotes all the attributes that another does, and more besides, which is distinguishing it, are called differential. Thus, man connotes all that animal does, and also, as differentiae, the erect gait, articulate speech, and other attributes. In such a case as this, where there are well-marked classes, the term whose connotation is included in the others is called a genus of that species. We have a genus, triangle, and a species, isosceles, marked off from all other triangles by the differential quality of having two equal sides. Again, genus, book, species, quarto, difference, having each sheet folded into four leaves. There are other cases where these expressions, genus and species, cannot be so applied without a departure from usage. As, for example, if we call snow a species of the genus white, for white is not a recognized class, the connotation of white, that is, whiteness, is, however, part of the connotation of snow, just as the qualities of animal are amongst those of man, and for logical purposes, it is desirable to use genus and species to express that relativity of terms which consist in the connotation of one being part of the connotation of the other. Two or more terms whose connotations severally include that of another term, whilst at the same time exceeding it, are, in relation to the other term, called coordinate. Thus, in relation to white, snow and silver are coordinate. In relation to color, yellow and red and blue are coordinate. And when all the terms are thus related, stand for recognized natural classes. The coordinate terms are called coordinate species. Thus, man and chamois are, in logic, coordinate species of the genus animal. Section 6. From such examples of term whose connotations are related as whole and part, it is easy to see the general truth of the doctrine that as connotation decreases, denotation increases. For animal, with less connotation than man or chamois, denotes many more objects. White, with less connotation than snow or silver, denotes many more things. It is not, however, certain that this doctrine is always true in the concrete. Since there may be a term connoting two or more qualities, all of which qualities are peculiar to all the things it denotes, and, if so, by subtracting one of the qualities from its connotation, we should not increase its denotation. If man, for example, has amongst mammals the two peculiar attributes of erect gait and articulate speech, then, by omitting articulate speech from the connotation of man, we could not apply the name to any more of the existing mammalia than we can at present. Still, we might have been able to do so. There might have been an erect, inarticulate ape, and perhaps there once was, and if so, to omit articulate from the connotation of man would make the term man denote that animal, supposing that there was no other difference to exclude it. Hence, potentially, an increase in the connotation of any term implies a decrease of its denotation. And on the other hand, We can only increase the denotation of a term or apply it to more objects by decreasing its connotation. 4. If the new things denoted by the term had already possessed its whole connotation, they must already have been denoted by it. However, we may decrease the known denotation without decreasing the connotation, if we can discover the full connotation in things not formally supposed to have it, as when dolphins were discovered to be mammals, or if we can impose the requisite qualities upon new individuals, as when, by annexing some millions of Africans, we extend the denotation of British subject without altering its connotation. Many of the things noticed in this chapter, especially in this section and the preceding, will be discussed at greater length in the chapters on classification and definition. Section 7. Contradictory relative terms. Every term has, or may have, another corresponding with it in such a way that whatever differential qualities it connotes, this other connotes merely their absence, so that one or the other is always formally predicable of any subject. But both these terms are never predicable of the same subject in the same relation. Such pairs of terms are called contradictories. Whatever subject we take, it is either visible or invisible, but not both. Either human or non-human, but not both. This, at least, is true formally, though in practice we should think ourselves trifled with if anyone told us that a mountain is either human or non-human, but not both. It is symbolic terms such as capitalized X and lowercase x that are properly said to be contradictories in relation to any subject whatever, S or M. For, as we have seen, the ordinary use of terms is limited by sum suppositio, and this is true of contradictories. Human and non-human may refer to zoological classification, or to the scope of physical, mental, or moral powers, as if we ask whether to flourish a dumbbell of a ton weight, or to know the future by intuition or impeccability, be human or non-human. Similarly, visible and invisible refer either to the point of emitting or reflecting light, so that the words have no hold upon a sound or a scent, or else to power of vision and such qualifications as with the naked eye or the microscope. Again, the above definition of contradictories tell us that they cannot be predicated of the same subject in the same relation. That is, at the same time or place or under the same conditions. The lamp is visible to me now, but will be invisible if I turn it out. One side of it is now visible, but the other side is not. Therefore, without this restriction, in the same relation, few or no terms would be contradictory. If a man is called wise, it may mean on the whole, or in a certain action, and clearly a man may for once be wise, or act wisely, who on the whole is not wise. So that here again, by this ambiguity, terms that seem contradictory are predicable of the same subject, but not in the same relation. In order to avoid the ambiguity, however, we have only to construct the term so as to express the relation as wise on the whole, and this immediately generates the contradictory not wise on the whole. Similarly, at one age a man may have black hair, at another not black hair, but the difficulty is practically removable by stating the age referred to. Still, this case easily leads us to real difficulty in the use of contradictory terms, a difficulty arising from the continuous change of flux or natural phenomena. If things are continually changing, it may be urged that contradictory terms are always applicable to the same subject, at least as fast as we can utter them. For, if we have just said that a man's hair is black, since, like everything else, his hair is changing, it must now be not black, though, to be sure, it may still seem black. The difficulty, such as it is, lies in this, that the human mind and its instrument language are not equal to the subtlety of nature. All things flow, but the terms of human discourse assume a certain fixity of things. Everything at every moment changes, but for the most part we can neither perceive this change nor express it in ordinary language. This paradox, however, may, I suppose, be easily overstated. The change that continually agitates nature consist in the movements of masses and molecules, and such movements of things are compatible with a considerable persistence of their qualities. Not only are the molecular changes always going on in a piece of gold compatible with its remaining yellow, but its persistent yellowness depends on the continuance of some of those changes. Similarly, a man's hair may remain black for some years, though, no doubt at a certain age, its color may begin to be problematical, and the applicability to it of black or not black may become a matter of genuine anxiety. Whilst being on our guard, then, against fallacies of contradiction arising from the imperfect correspondence of fact with thought and language, we shall often have to put up with it. Candor and humility have been satisfied by the above acknowledgement of the subtlety of nature, we may henceforward proceed upon the postulate that it is possible to use contradictory terms such as cannot both be predicated of the same subject in the same relation, though one of them may be that, for example, it may be truly said of a man for some years that his hair is black, and if so, that during those years to call it not black is false or extremely misleading. The most opposed terms of the literary vocabulary, however, such as wise, foolish, old, young, sweet, bitter, are rarely true contradictories. Wise and foolish, indeed, cannot be predicated of the same man in the same relation. But there are many middling men of whom neither can be predicated on the whole. For the comparison of quantities again, we have three correlative terms, greater, equal, less, and none of these is the contradictory of either of the others. In fact, the contradictory of any term is one that denotes the sum of its coordinates, and to obtain a contradictory, the surest way is to coin one by prefixing to the given term the particular not, or sometimes non, as wise, not wise, human, non-human, greater, not greater. The separate word not is surer to constitute a contradictory than the usual prefixes of negation, un, or in, or even non, since compounds of these are generally warped by common use from a purely negative meaning. Thus, nonconformist does not denote everybody who fails to conform. Unwise is not equivalent to not wise, but means rather foolish. A very foolish action is not wise, but can only be called unwise by meiosis or irony. Still, negatives formed by in, or un, or non are sometimes really contradictory of their positives, as visible, invisible, equal, unequal. Section 8. The distinction between positive and negative terms is not of much value in logic. What importance would else attach to it being absorbed by the more definite distinction of contradictories? For contradictories are positive and negative in essence, and when least ambiguously stated, also in form. And on the other hand, as we have seen, when positive and negative terms are not contradictory, they are misleading, as with wise, unwise, so with many others, such as happy, unhappy, which are not contradictories, since a man may be neither happy nor unhappy, but indifferent, or, again, so miserable that he can only be called unhappy by a figure of speech. In fact, in the common vocabulary, a formal negative often has a limited positive sense, and this is the case with unhappy, signifying the state of feeling in the milder shades of purgatory. When a negative term is fully contradictory of its positive, it is said to be infinite, because it denotes an unassertain multitude of things, a multitude only limited by the positive term, and the suppositio, thus not wise, denotes all except the wise, within the suppositio of intelligent beings. Formally, disregarding any suppositio, such a negative term stands for all possible terms except its positive. Lowercase x denotes everything but capital X, and not wise may be taken to include stones, triangles, and hippogriffs. And even in this sense, a negative term has some positive meaning, though a very indefinite one, not a specific positive force like unwise or unhappy. It denotes any and everything that is not the attributes connoted by the corresponding positive term. Privative terms connote the absence of a quality that normally belongs to the kind of thing denoted, as blind or deaf. We may predicate blind or deaf of a man, dog, or cow that happens not to be able to see or hear, because the powers of seeing and hearing generally belong to those species. But of a stone or idol, these terms can only be used figuratively. Indeed, since the contradictory of a privative carries with it the privative limitation, a stone is strictly not blind. That is, it is not something that normally having sight wants it. Contrary terms are those that, within a certain genus or suppositio, severally connote differential qualities that are, in fact, mutually incompatible in the same relation to the same thing, and therefore cannot be predicated of the same subject in the same relation, and, so far, they resemble contradictory terms, but they differ from contradictory terms in this, that the differential quality connoted by each of them is definitely positive. No contrary term is infinite, but is limited to the part of the suppositio excluded by the others. So, that possibly neither of two contraries is truly predicable of a given subject. Thus, blue and red are contraries, for they cannot both be predicated of the same thing in the same relation, but are not contradictories, since, in a given case, neither may be predicable. If a flower is blue in a certain part, it cannot in the same part be red, but it may be neither blue nor red, but yellow, though it is certainly either blue or not blue. All coordinate terms are formal contraries, but if, in fact, a series of coordinates comprises only two, as male, female, they are empirical contradictories, since each includes all that area of the suppositio which the other excludes. The extremes of a series of coordinate terms are opposites, as in a list of colors, white and black. The most strongly contrasted are said to be opposites, or as among moods of feelings, rapture and misery are opposites. But this distinction is of slight logical importance. Imperfect positive and negative couples, like happy and unhappy, which, as we have seen, are not contradictories, are often called opposites. The members of any series of contraries are all included by any one of them in its contradictory, as all colors come under red and not red, all moods of feeling under happy and not happy. The end of chapter 4. Read by Brian Luther for Lit2Go. Available on the web at fcit.usf.edu.